Coming up, as the Smithsonian's new African American Museum opens in Washington this weekend, Kim Lawton looks at how it portrays the role of faith. And what one woman in San Diego has done to try to help the poorest of the poor in Tijuana, Mexico. Also, belief and practice, saying the central prayer in the Jewish tradition.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week, President Obama made his final appearance as U.S. President at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. In his address, he urged the international community not to be divided along lines of tribe, race, and religion. Obama also hosted one of two special summits on the global refugee crisis. In a joint statement after the summits, world leaders pledged to accept more refugees and commit more money to humanitarian aid. They also promised to expand refugees' access to education and employment. Several faith-based groups played a key role in the effort. The ongoing civil war in Syria was another major topic of debate. On Wednesday in New York, representatives from a broad array of faith groups held a prayer vigil seeking an end to the conflict. They condemned the humanitarian toll of the violence and demanded that world leaders take more concrete steps to achieve peace. The religious leaders urged more dialogue and called for an immediate end to all bombing campaigns and other military actions. Pope Francis traveled to Assisi, Italy this week in honor of the 30th World Day of Prayer for Peace. He met with religious leaders from around the world, including Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby, and representatives from Islam, Judaism, and Buddhism. Francis also invited 12 refugees from various countries to share a meal. Pope John Paul II established the World Day of Prayer for Peace in 1986, when all involved in conflicts were asked to put down their arms for a day. Faith leaders are expressing alarm after the fatal shooting of a protester in Charlotte, North Carolina. 25 members of the Charlotte Clergy Coalition for Justice say they believe the protester was shot by police. City officials describe the shooting as a civilian-on-civilian confrontation. Unrest in Charlotte erupted after police fatally shot Keith Scott, a black man who police say was armed. Religious groups are among those who've condemned the recent terrorist attacks in Minnesota and New York. A 22-year-old Somali immigrant stabbed 10 people at a mall in St. Cloud as he made a reference to Allah. The assailant was shot dead by an off-duty police officer, and ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack. A man suspected of planting bombs in Manhattan that injured dozens of people was captured after a Sikh man spotted the suspect asleep and alerted authorities. The Sikh American said he realized he, quote, could have been mistaken for the perpetrator, but said that his faith teaches justice and tolerance for all. Hate crimes against American Muslims are at their highest levels since the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, according to new data from researchers at California State University in San Bernardino. The researchers found that hate crimes were up 78% in 2015 compared to the previous year. They estimated there were about 260 hate crimes in 2015. The findings were based on official police reports in 20 states. Scholars say the crimes have been driven by the string of recent terrorist attacks here in the U.S. and abroad, as well as by political rhetoric from some candidates. Here in Washington this weekend, the official opening of the Smithsonian's highly anticipated new National Museum of African American History and Culture. The museum devotes significant attention to the wide-ranging role of faith in the African American experience. Kim Lawton got an advance look.
The Smithsonian's new National Museum of African American History and Culture has a lofty purpose: to help the world better understand the complex African American journey and how that journey has shaped the nation. For many African Americans, the museum's presence on the National Mall is a profound statement in and of itself.
There's a sense that we have arrived, that we are a part of the mainstream, that we matter to the body politic, that E Pluribus Unum actually may include us.
Spirituality, so important to the African American journey, is embedded in the building's very structure. The design was inspired by a West African corona, or crown. According to the architect, it reaches to the sky in an expression of faith, hope, and perseverance. The museum's founding director, historian Lonnie Bunch, says his team wanted to portray the full range of the African-American experience.
We also thought, while America should ponder the pain of slavery and segregation, it also had to find the joy, the hope, the resiliency, the spirituality that was endemic in this community.
Of the museum's more than 3,000 artifacts on display, about 10% are religious. The exhibitions are grouped into three main categories: history, community, and culture. Faith is prominent in all of them. Dr. Rex Ellis, an ordained Baptist minister, is the museum's associate director for curatorial affairs.
There's no way you can talk about, discuss, or even acknowledge the contribution of African American history without acknowledging the very real presence and power of faith as a part of that history.
Howard University's School of Divinity Dean Alton Pollard III specializes in religion and culture. He applauds the museum for incorporating religion throughout its exhibits.
When you take culture away and simply refer to timelines, events, occurrences, without understanding what are all the nuances that give meaning to those timelines, then you lose something. So culture is absolutely imperative. And what's at the root of culture? Religion.
While Christianity and the Black Church are given the most attention, the museum also highlights other religions. Islam receives a strong focus, both the Nation of Islam and mainstream Sunni Islam. But Judaism, voodoo, African traditional religions, and folk spirituality are also acknowledged. One large piece of art is a bottle tree thought to capture evil spirits. Ellis says it's all part of the stories of African Americans.
Whatever the faith tradition, it was significant and important in terms of them being able to make a way out of no way.
In a deliberately symbolic plan, visitors are asked to start at the bottom of the museum in galleries that examine America's history of slavery and the fight for freedom. Among the artifacts displayed here, a bloodstained Bible owned by Nat Turner, the slave who led a famous rebellion. Also, a hymnal owned by abolitionist Harriet Tubman. Exhibits show slaves looking to faith to find hope.
That there was something more powerful and more important than a malevolent master on earth, as long as they understood and believed that there was a benevolent master that superseded all that they could imagine themselves. Their lives had meaning, and that meaning was beyond this place and this space that they happened to be in.
As visitors walk to upper levels of the museum, they move through history. Exhibits on the era after emancipation explore the establishment of African American institutions, including schools and churches. The museum also examines bigotry, segregation, and violence. In some areas, there are warning signs that the images may not be appropriate for younger and more sensitive visitors. Pollard says he hopes visitors will look at those exhibits with an open mind.
We have to look at the blemishes and the warts, as well as all of the beauty marks that constitute who we are as a society. And in so doing, now creating the opportunity for us to engage in honest dialogue and more just action.
Many exhibits note the key role of Black churches in the civil rights movement, from the leadership of pastors Martin Luther King Jr. and Fred Shuttlesworth to the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. On display are fragments from one of the church's destroyed stained glass windows. The section covering 1968 and beyond looks at the time after King's assassination, the influence of Black liberation theology, and the growth of Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam. The top floors of the museum focus on contributions of African Americans in several arenas, including the military, sports, fine arts, and contemporary culture. The substantial Musical Crossroads Gallery highlights sacred music. Artifacts here include the piano of Thomas Dorsey, called the father of gospel music, along with a lime green suit worn by the gospel group the Dixie Hummingbirds and their 1973 Grammy. Group member Reverend Joe Williams is pleased to be part of it.
There's so many people who planted the trees that other people can enjoy the shade now. We should know the story of the struggle.
In addition to the exhibits, the museum houses the Center for the Study of African American Religion, dedicated to preserving religious artifacts and researching African American faith. The center was established through a grant from the Lilly Endowment. The amount of material can be overwhelming, and many people are already complaining about what is and isn't covered. Pollard says the museum should not be considered the final word on the Black experience.
There is a danger if it is assumed that the museum can encapsulate everything that is to be said about African Americans. That would certainly be tragic.
Indeed, Smithsonian Institution Secretary David Scorton says one of the main goals of the new museum is to facilitate ongoing conversations about race and culture.
This museum can be an ideal gathering place to learn, to hold conversations, to be inspired, and to be uplifted.
Bunch says it's not just about the past.
Ultimately, this museum looks back, helps contextualize where we are, but hints at what a future can be, can maybe even help us find reconciliation and healing.
Pollard says as a minister, he hopes the museum's emphasis on faith can help provide a new vision.
These people have such a profound faith, no matter how one's faith is defined. They had such a profound recognition that in the midst of severe trial and terror, they yet and still could believe in a God that would bring salvation to their individual lives, but more importantly, to their collective lives. They believe so profoundly in the power of the sacred that it would even be possible for their faithfulness to redeem the nation.
He believes that's a lesson still greatly needed today. I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
The museum's director, Lonnie Bunch, said, "This is a story for us all, not just one community." We have a Lucky Severson story today on what one woman in San Diego has been able to accomplish to help the very poor in Mexico, just south of the border. Her name is Paula Clausen. She's a retired travel agent who was so shocked when she first saw the shanty towns of Tijuana that she recruited volunteers to build homes for the people there. So far, they've built nearly 1,300 small houses at the rate of about one per day.
Paula Clausen has made this trip so many times, from the comfort of her home north of San Diego, across the border into Mexico, into a world of shanty towns where people struggle every day to survive. The name of this colonia is
Fuentes del Valle, which is hilarious. It means fountains of the valley, and they have no running water. Maybe one day they'll have a fountain. There's a truck that comes around called a pipa, and they fill up great big barrels of water, and that's how they get it. But for drinking water, they have to go and buy it.
Oh yes, there's no electricity, no sewer, no indoor toilets.
houses, you can't even call them houses, shacks made of scrap wood, some people living in cars, roofs that leak, and because of the dirt floors when it rained, of course, mud.
Maria says in the last storm, the shanty she and her three daughters were living in and many others blew away. But that won't be happening to her new house, the one going up now, thanks to Paula Clausen.
Good grief, last time I was here, and I looked over there, it was nothing but little shacks. And look at it now, look at the number of houses. I did not realize we had done so many. All the colored houses are ours.
Stop painting, you've got to prime before you paint.
She and her volunteers have constructed almost 1,300 houses, each one in less than a day. They also built this community center that serves as a village church. Who would have thought, certainly not Paula Clausen, that this plain-spoken mother of two retired travel agent would become the CEO of a nonprofit foundation called Project Mercy.
Paula Clausen first came to the shanty towns of Tijuana in 1991. She came with a church friend to donate used clothing and blankets. What she found here, about 25 miles south of one of the richest cities in the U.S., changed her life in ways she never imagined, and the lives of many others.
I could see smiling faces, but desperation in their eyes. And I thought, well, surely I can do something.
And so here's what she did. She started helping repair the shanties, and then she contacted the TV stations around San Diego. She wanted publicity, but not for herself.
I went to the local media and said, listen, this is what I'm doing. Will you do an article? And so they did. And because of this media coverage, more people got to hear about it and more people started volunteering.
And then she took a grant writing course, and the first grant she was awarded was from a very famous American charity called Newman's Own.
The check had been signed by Paul Newman himself on Christmas Day in 1998. And that was an incredible, uplifting surprise.
But what she needed most were volunteers, and among the first to show up was Mike Mazier and his family of eight kids. Mazier manufactures parts for race cars. He's a devout Catholic from St. Timothy's Church in Escondido, California. He and his kids and volunteers from the church have built about 80 houses. Materials for each house cost about $5,000.
I don't think there's anything that I could do that could change a family's life as significantly in one day as what we do here.
He says when his kids bring their friends here, it makes an impression, one they won't likely forget soon.
And the kids were absolutely stunned. I mean, it was dead quiet from going from a very noisy van all the way down to, oh my goodness, this is reality. It's not just something that you might see on TV every now and then.
Not only are the people here benefiting and becoming stronger communities, but the people from the States are learning about the people here. They're learning about each other, and it's very uplifting.
This was Ryan Lanz's first trip here.
It's just incredible the way that these folks live, such sweet people.
Volunteers have come from across the U.S., including this group with international relief teams based in San Diego. This is Jenna Montgomery.
It's a good reminder for us to be more grateful for what we have.
Not all volunteers are from the U.S. Those fortunate enough to get a brand new colorful home are required first to have helped build other homes for their neighbors. It's called sweat equity. Mr. Roscoe worked on 15 homes before he and his family earned the one being built today.
I have one bedroom, one living room, like little kitchen.
Antonio lived with his wife and daughter and ailing father in a truck for 4 months before he earned his new home.
It's really important to have a house for the family, not for us, for the little kids in the future.
It's all about the children, and there are 20 million living in poverty in Mexico, 5 million in extreme poverty. Few get to help paint their mom's new home.
They don't know, really, the misery that they live in the way their parents do. Their parents fear for them in the winter, and they fear for them because of the vermin that enters the shacks they live in. But they are so joyful, they find happiness in everything.
It's looking good. just got to get the railing in up on the top there, and then it's all done.
There's a great sense of satisfaction, but it's not because of what I've done. I think it's because of what we're doing with the gifts that God has given us. It's our obligation. I mean, for those that have been given much, much is expected, and I think we need to really pay attention to that.
I want to give you the keys for your house. Suerte por tu futura y de los niños. ¿A quién? A la mamá. Al señor. Okay? Oh, it gives you a good feeling. I always say that next to raising my children, this has really, truly validated my life. Not many people get to live and work their dream, and this has become a living dream.
Come October, Project Mercy will host the annual Baja Challenge, where dozens and sometimes hundreds of volunteers show up. One year, they built 44 houses in one day. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Tijuana, Mexico.
Finally, belief and practice. The central prayer in Judaism is the Amidah. It's traditionally recited three times a day, as well as on the Sabbath and holidays. Rabbi Shira Stutman from the Sixth and I Historic Synagogue in Washington told us the prayer is a spiritual time to be in silent conversation with God.
The Amidah is considered the central prayer in the Jewish tradition. It's considered the time in the prayer service where we are most open spiritually and we're really ready to talk to God. The Amidah is known as a silent prayer. And one of the reasons for the silence is because a person shouldn't be distracted from the conversation that they are having with God. But actually, if you go to a more traditional synagogue during the Amidah, it will not be silent, because people will actually be sort of whispering, muttering the prayer to themselves under their breath, because we are actually supposed to be in conversation, right? We speak aloud to God, and God speaks in God's own way to us. We request the God that we be protected, that we be healthy. But when it's Shabbat or holidays, we are offering our gratitude to God. We are grateful for the Sabbath, for instance. We are grateful for God's holiness. The first part of the Amidah is the moment where we reflect on our ancestors, being descendants of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, and of course in contemporary times, we also say, of Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. And because of their merit, and because of the ways that they interacted with God in ancient history, so too may God be gracious to us and protect us and help us live to be our best selves. As we begin the Amidah, we begin by taking three steps backward and then three steps forward as if we are entering God's kingdom. We begin with bowing before God, right? We bend our knees, we bow down as we say the words, Baruch Atah, blessed are you. And then we rise up as we say God's name, believing that it is God or God's presence that can somehow lift the fallen. You will often see, if you go into a Jewish prayer service, people using their bodies during the Amidah in one of two ways. Either they are moving back and forth wildly, we call that in Yiddish shuckling, right? As if it is a sort of dance that they are doing with God. Or sometimes in some Hasidic traditions, they actually stand stock still. When we say the Kiddusha, we are actually supposed to rise up on our toes like we are angels. It is an embodied prayer. At the end of the Amidah, we take three steps back. We are exiting God's kingdom. We bow to the left, to the right, in front of us as we say this prayer for peace. And then we rise up again on our tiptoes, right? As a way of recognition of all the holiness that we have just been a part of. One of the themes that is complicated for a lot of Jews who are saying the Amidah is the theme of the resurrection of the dead. But even the idea of Mechaye HaMetim, the one who brings the dead back to life, can have meaning even for those of us who don't necessarily believe in the resurrection of the dead, because we understand this concept of being broken. We're talking about those moments that all of us have experienced of feeling bereft, right? The dark night of the soul, some people will call it. Those are the moments that God can help resurrect us. This prayer that goes back thousands of years can be changed, and it can also be kept as it is and given new meaning and made eternally meaningful for the Jewish people.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, music from a special concert at the Washington National Cathedral to celebrate the opening of the new African American Museum.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.